Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 138. Today on the Amateur Traveler, I talk to myself about my recent trip to England and Greece, learn about driving in Crete, the beauty of Santorini, and the Beatles tour in Liverpool. Today on the Amateur Traveler. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen, and I'm back. I've been on vacation recently, as you may have noticed from the two reruns that we had, but I am back. We won't be doing a regular show today, which would normally involve an interview with someone else, but instead I'll be telling you about my recent trip and some of the things that I learned in both England and Greece. But before we get into that, I did have one news story I wanted to tell you about. There was a post on the Amateur Traveler discussion boards, amateurtraveler.com/board, recently about how to make money traveling. Actually, I think the post originally said how to travel for free. And this was a link to leaveatease.com, which is one of a series of many, many sites on the internet, over 178,000 according to numbers that I found, which are sponsored by ytb.com, which is an online travel agency that sells through other independent travel agencies. And basically the idea here is that you can make money as an online travel agent. And this is a multi-level marketing program. That is, that if you get 10 people to sign up, you get a share of their commission as well. And so I've seen a lot of things about it on the internet. If you Google YTB, you'll find many, many very opinionated but non-authoritative sites. That is, people who've done a lot of search engine optimization to make sure that they grab the term YTB, but not sites that are doing independent analysis. All of the information that I have found is very biased information, either for or against. But it's very difficult to tell what is the value of doing this. So I've done some independent analysis because YTB.com is a real company. They have board of directors who are coming from Carnival, one's an ex-senator and such. So it's not a fly-by-night company, and I don't believe it's a scam from what I'm seeing. It is an over-the-counter traded company. And because of that, it's under SEC guidelines. And because I work at a company that is been under similar guidelines, I'm familiar with how to read those documents. And so up on Tripinator.com, I posted a blog post about what I found as I looked into this company. And the bottom line, if you're looking into something like this, is this company, and I think many others like it that are trying to do a multi-level marketing travel agency business, make most of their money from the fees from their members and actually make a relatively small portion of their money from actually selling travel. And so they use the money from members to pay members predominantly. And you can see the analysis that I put on the site that goes into much more details about that. And specifically, using some numbers from the postings that they had to send to the SEC, if you take the amount of commissions that they paid and divide it by the number of members that they reported, their average member had $90 at the last time they reported the number of members, and that was a year ago, per quarter in multi-level marketing payments. That is, in they got paid because they had gotten other people to sign up, and then they made, on average, $9 in travel commissions per quarter. If you add that up, the average person did not pay for their entrance fees. Now, obviously, some made a lot more than that, and some made nothing. But I am not recommending this sort of thing. And just to let you know, I'm not opposed to making money on travel. I'm not opposed to travel businesses. In fact, if I thought that this was something that would be of value to you, not just something that I could make money on, I would be doing this because I am not opposed to making money with this show. For those of you who've been around for a while, you know that we have done sponsorships. I will do sponsorships again in the future. In fact, at the end of this show, I will talk to you about some of the ways that I'm hoping to make some money with this as a side business. So I'm not opposed to that. It's just that I don't find this to be the most valuable thing. If you're interested in becoming an online travel agency, I would recommend check out the Home-Based Travel Agent podcast that Barry Kantz does, a friend of mine, and learn more about actually getting into the business and making your money on travel commissions. So, but I did want to put something up about this because it has come up in the discussion boards. And I didn't want to just delete it from the discussion boards because I thought it was a useful discussion to have, because I think a lot of us would like to support our travel habits with a side business potentially or with something that would make it more valuable. I hope you find that of value. I'd be interested in your comments on that. You can post them on the blog post, OprahandTripinator.com, and you can find a link to that on the show notes at AmateurTraveler.com. As I mentioned in the introduction, I would normally introduce a guest at this point and we would do an interview, but we're not going to do that this week. Next week, we'll get back to our normal format. But I did just get back from a 2.5-week trip, and I want to tell you a little more about that. In the trip, we went to both England and Greece. Greece was really the main focus of this particular trip, and we went to Athens and Santorini and Crete, three different places in Crete, and we'll talk about that in some detail. And since we were flying through London, and I hadn't been really to London outside of Heathrow and Windsor for a few hours for about 9 years, it really was time to get back to London because I love the city of London, as you know from the show that we did earlier on London. And there were certainly some new things that I hadn't seen, and we had a little extra time, so I wanted to see more of England. And my wife and daughter decided that our first stop would be Liverpool. And you can hear more on Liverpool with the show we did with Don McAllister of the Screencast Online podcast about all the different things to see in Liverpool. In fact, we met up with Don while we were there and had a nice chat. The main reason that we went was to do the Beatles Magic Mystery Tour. So it was the Beatles connection to Liverpool that got us there. And we had talked about that on the previous podcast on Liverpool, but Don hadn't actually been on it. So I did want to give you some feedback before we get into Greece about that. It was a very interesting tour. I am not as big a Beatles fan as my daughter is or as my wife is. And so I almost didn't go on it, but I really was glad that I had because we learned a lot of things that I didn't know. I didn't know that, and you may know this already, that John Lennon's first band was not a rock band, but a skiffle band. In fact, most of the bands at the time in that particular area, the Paul's first band also would have been a skiffle band. And a skiffle band, think washboard in a bathtub bass instead of electric bass and drums. So it's a very different style of music. And one of the things they did on the tour is they played not just lots and lots of Beatles music, but they also played things like here's a skiffle piece and what skiffle would sound like and all of the groups that were playing that at the time. And the first record that the Beatles actually recorded was recorded as backup singers for another singer, and it was a rock version of My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean. And so they played some of that for us. And the Beatles were selling that single at some of their events when they would play. And it was then that Brian Epstein heard about their music as people would come into the record store he owned and ask to buy this record that was not in circulation. And so that was the kind of thing you learn in the tour. You get to see the church where they met, where Paul and John met while John's band was playing. And in that church, there's a grave for Eleanor Rigby. So if you're a Beatles fan, I think that that is something that you would enjoy doing in Liverpool. In London, some of the things that were new since we were there previously were the London Eye. So we did go up on the London Eye and enjoyed that thoroughly in the views of the city. It was not the clearest of days in London because it was London. But we also got a chance to go to the Globe Theater, which has been there for a while, but I had not yet a chance to see a play in the Globe Theater. And that was great fun. We saw The Midsummer Night's Dream, which was one of the best productions I've seen of that. I almost didn't go again because I've seen so many productions of that particular play. Although I suspect that Shakespeare didn't have to contend with jets flying overhead. We also did have the experience, as we did in Sydney, Australia a few years back, of stumbling across a movie set, and we saw the filming on the south bank of the Thames of a scene of an upcoming movie with Dustin Hoffman and stood less than 10 feet away from him, so that was a fun experience. I wish my filmmaker son had been there to share it with us. I'll get my trip journal up on the web in a few days at tripinator.com, and you can have all the details of the trip. So I'm just going to hit some of the highlights because I do want to move on, and I want to move on to Greece for this particular episode. One other personal highlight for me is I did get to meet Craig and Linda. They have been on the show before, both talking about New Zealand as well as Malta of the Indie Travel podcast, and we got a chance to actually meet face-to-face for coffee just outside of Harrods, so that was great fun. And that being said, let's move on to Greece. As I said, we did three particular stops. The first of our stops was the city of Athens. And we had never been to Greece before, either to the island Santorini or Crete that we went to, as well as to the mainland, to either Athens or to southern Greece, the Peloponnese. And we did enjoy it a lot. But as we had been told, a lot of recommendations we had for Athens. Athens, remember, as well as London, rated as two of the dirtiest cities in Europe. And we had a lot of advice that if you go to Athens, just see the sights and then get out to some of the islands or get down to the Peloponnese and really don't spend a lot of time in there. And that's probably similar to what my advice would be. We ended up staying two nights, and as you'll see in the trip journal, we didn't spend quite as much as I probably would advise. Didn't stay, for instance, in the lovely region beneath the Acropolis called the Plaka, but instead stayed out by a region called Omonia Square, and that's really pretty much a seedy region. You'll see more details in my trip journal when you look at that. So I wouldn't recommend staying there. And so I would recommend you stay in the Plaka or the Monastiraki area, which are just under the Acropolis. But you may need to book further ahead than we were doing to find a more affordable hotel in that area because it's going to cost a little more. But we just saved a little too much money and stayed in an area where it wasn't as nice, and I wouldn't recommend it. So Athens itself, the main sights that I wanted to see when we were there were the Acropolis, the Parthenon on the top of the Acropolis, the Agora or the Old Greek Forum just below the Acropolis, as well as the Plaka area, which is that twisty path of streets that is both picturesque and good for shopping. My wife and daughter would tell you that is also just below the Acropolis. And then also the archaeological museum. Those are the main things that I wanted to see in Athens. And really, that only took us about a day and a half to see all that. And we did end up taking what was going to be two full days in Athens and shortening that so we could catch a high-speed ferry to Santorini. First, the Parthenon. That really was an experience that all three of us, and that by this time on the trip it is my wife, Joan, my daughter, Liz, and I, really found that this is one of those see it before you die kind of places, and it was just wonderful to be standing up on the top of the Acropolis, both to look at the view of the city and also to stand there with the history that is involved in that particular area. Unfortunately, the Parthenon itself is under a lot of scaffolding right now, so that distracted a little from it, but still a wonderful experience to get up there. You have to wade through quite a lot of tour groups, and there's quite a press of traffic getting up to the top, and you do walk up to the top of the Acropolis. And again, that was one of the first of many times in this trip where we were so, so glad that we were there in May rather than in the heat of the summer and in the press of the crowds of the summer. May is a wonderful time to go, and also from the people we talked to while we were there, after September 15th, the other shoulder season, is another great time to go to Athens. A lot of tourists still, but not nearly as many as you would find in the heat of the summer. Warm days, beautiful weather we ran into, but not quite the oppressive heat you'd run into in the summer. You do have to walk up to the Acropolis. There will be people selling you cold water or parasols or postcards if you just want to skip the whole thing and bring back postcards of the Acropolis, but truly an enjoyable experience going up there. We also did enjoy the Plaka. As I said, even with the euro at $1.5 per euro, my wife and daughter did find a number of deals, a number of bargains, sandals on sale for 5 euros or jewelry for 5 or 10 euros. So it really wasn't bad. London was oppressive in terms of the prices often, but not so much in Greece, even with the low dollar right now. And so our dynamic was my daughter and my wife would shop, and I would wander around them taking pictures of the area, or in Athens particularly, where there are just ruins everywhere, stopping in to see the Roman Forum or stopping in to see some other particular ruin that was nearby. And the one museum that I did do was the Archaeology Museum, as I mentioned. And the most famous piece there is probably the Mask of Agamemnon, which is a Mycenaean funeral mask, which is attributed to be the Mask of Agamemnon. We don't know if it really is, but Agamemnon was a king from the Mycenaean era. And one of the most interesting things I found in the museum, though, were the sculpture pieces, larger pieces, and especially to track the change in Greek sculpture from originally a more Egyptian-inspired style, a very stiff style where everything is similar, and then going on to the much more realistic style of the Golden Age where people have real sinews and muscles that show through in the sculptures. It was just great. Our next stop was Santorini, and we did get there by high-speed ferry. One thing I should mention is it was difficult to book the high-speed ferry. I kept trying to book it on the internet, and the booking system on the internet never worked for me. So that's something to be aware of. So we did do two different things for the two high-speed ferries that we booked for to and from Santorini. To Santorini, we actually ended up going down to the port in Athens and booking the ferry directly because we hadn't been able to. And then I'll tell you a little more about the travel agent that we found on Santorini later. Santorini is, as you have seen, if you've seen pictures of it, a spectacularly beautiful island. It's a crescent moon-shaped island that is the remains of an ancient volcano. The largest eruption from Santorini that happened 1,500 years BC was thought to have caused the downfall of the Minoan civilization. And the Minoan civilization, which started in Crete, was the first European civilization. There are some Minoan ruins on Santorini at Akrotiri, and unfortunately, we were not able to see them because there was an accident 2 years ago, and they are currently closed. They are hoping to reopen this summer, in part, is one rumor we heard, possibly not until next year. But we did stay in Akrotiri, and one of the most enjoyable things of our stay in Santorini was that we stayed at the Matheos village, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes, and our host, Kostas Papalexis, was really an introduction for us into Greek hospitality, more so than our hotel in Athens, which I said was a disappointment. But Kostas had more time to spend with us because it was May. He said that if we had been there in high season, all the rooms would have been booked. They would have been running around like crazy. The restaurant, wonderful restaurant run by Mama, there on the site, we would have need reservations for. We saw four cruise ships in the harbor and thought, gee, that's a lot. And he said in the summertime, in the high season, they've seen as many as 15. So it's quite a different experience. Going in May, he had a chance to just sit down with us and spend some time just shooting the breeze and sent over ouzo after dinner. And it was just a very different experience being there when they had a little time to breathe. He also runs a travel agent, and I should mention that because I do the show, I actually now have a lot less time to plan my trips, which seems strangely ironic. And so by the time we got to Santorini, we still had no plans at all for Crete, where we would stay. We didn't have a rental car. We didn't have tickets. And as I said again, getting tickets on the ferry proved to be a problem because I couldn't just do it from the internet. And that really binds me because that's how I'm used to doing things. So we did use his Akrotiri travel agency, which is his own travel agency, and he booked all of our reservations then for Crete, so we just didn't need to worry about that. And I'll put a link to both the travel agency and the hotel in the show notes. Kostas did recommend that we get a rental car for a couple days that we were there, because if you take the buses, all the buses go into Fira, which is the main town, and so you have to go from wherever you are to Fira and then back out again. And so it was easy to get around with a rental car once I remastered driving a standard on hilly roads. But we went all over the island, really, from one end to the other. The classic thing to do is up at Ia, which is the northern end of the island, go up there and watch the sunset, and we did that with the tourists and all their tour buses who had been dropped off by the cruise ships. But that's a pretty view, probably not as special for those of us who live on the west coast and get to see sunsets. We also went to a couple beaches. We went to Perevalos Beach as well as to Kamari Beach. Those are both rocky black sand beaches. And one of the interesting experiences we had at Kamari Beach was we went, and Kamari Beach has your beach umbrellas and chaises, as you usually see in European beaches. And so we assumed we were going to have to rent them. So we sat down and I went to look for the fellow to rent them from, and he came over, and his English wasn't much better than my Greek, but we were able to communicate that when I asked what the rental was, he said today was free. Just turns out that they had opened the restaurant yesterday, and this was associated with the restaurant. But then I got the impression that we did need order from the menu. Okay, that's fine. We can do that. What do you have? He said, how about coffee? And Joan said, well, how about iced tea? So he went back to check to see if he had iced tea, and he came back and said, no, but he has coffee and champagne. Well, like, how much is it? Well, it's free because they just opened the restaurant. So basically what we learned is we had to have some of their free champagne if we were going to use their free umbrella. We were okay with that. The other thing that we did is we did do an excursion out to the two volcanoes. I said ancient volcano. There are active volcanoes in Santorini. There are two islands in the middle of the harbor, Nea Kamini and Palaia Kamini, New Smoking Island and Old Smoking Island. And we hiked to the top of the taller volcano, Nea Kamini, and got a wonderful view of the whole island. And the tour guide was fabulous. He was fluent at least enough to do his spiel in six different languages, as I recall. And so we would stop at various places along the hike, and he would explain to us the volcanology or the history of the big eruption in 1500 BC. And it just really added a lot to that particular tour. So the bottom line on Santorini is it's gorgeous, it's very touristed. About 90% of the economy is tourism because it's so gorgeous. The best shopping is in Fira, and probably the prettiest city would be in Ia, there at the northern tip. From Santorini, we took the catamaran, the high-speed ferry, into Heraklion in Crete. I should mention something about the harbor at Santorini, because it's an interesting scene. When you first arrive at the harbor, in either place, it's just a bustle activity. In Santorini, when you get there, there's a ferry arriving, there are buses there are taxis there are people with signs for guest houses, there are places you can rent cars, and it's just chaotic in nature, but just a very interesting scene. So anyway, one of the most interesting things about the ferry to Crete was that I was sitting next to a woman from Dallas who spends half her year in Crete running a bed and breakfast, Helen Swanston, and I'll put a link to her bed and breakfast. And she basically is a Greek American and runs this side business of a bed and breakfast. And she also does individual tours where she will take people around through not just Crete, but throughout the Greek islands and such. And so she was getting back from doing a tour of Santorini with her niece and a niece's friend. And that will figure into the story later on as we get on in Crete. But we arrived in Heraklion, and a lot of people had told us that Heraklion was some place to just kind of buzz through, that it wasn't as interesting as Rethymno and Chania, which we were going to spend the next 4 nights total. So we spent one night only in Heraklion, but we actually enjoyed it. It had quite a nightlife in the downtown area, quite a lot of cafes out in the center of the city, the old city still surrounded by its Venetian walls. Crete had a heavy Venetian as well as Turkish influence on it, and so it's interesting to see a lot of the places that we went to, the three cities, had Venetian walls left over from that time period. Now, the main reason that we went to Heraklion was because of the ruins of the Palace of Minos at Knossos, which is just north of Heraklion. So we rented a car and drove up there without any incident and got to see this Minoan ruin. And being someplace that is 3,500 years old is still, for me, just a thrilling experience. Now, this particular excavation had been done a while ago, and at the early onset of archaeology in the 1800s, there was a different style. So a lot of it was recreation, and a lot of it was the imagination of the archaeologist, the English archaeologist who had done it. But still, it was very interesting to see, get some idea of this city that was built with even running water and flush toilets back 1500 BC. So quite an advanced civilization for its time. And that was just thrilling for me to look at. We took an English-speaking tour so that we would get more out of it than just, oh, look, there's a column. I wonder what that's for. And I was glad that we did. And so we learned that the palace, for instance, was at least five different constructions, one on top of the other. The first two weren't palaces. The third and fourth were palaces and were destroyed in earthquakes caused by eruptions on Santorini, the second one being in 1500 BC. And really at that time, the Mycenaeans then rose in and took over this area and drove the Minoans up to the hills. Mycenaeans, as we said, would be the Greeks from the time period of the Trojan War. In mythology, the palace is the palace of the labyrinth. And that's true, but unfortunately, labyrinth is a poor translation of the Minoan word, or the Greek word, actually, I believe, for double-headed axe, because it was a place where sacrifices were made of bulls with a double-headed axe. And probably they thought that some of the stories of the Greek heroes who had gone down and never come back weren't really eaten by the bull, the Minotaur, the beast that lived in the labyrinth, but probably had died trying to jump over the bull in ceremonies that were done to show your athletic prowess. And so that may be where the origin of those particular stories of the Minotaur and the labyrinth come from on the palace of Knossos of Minos in Crete. Now, I said we didn't have any trouble getting out to Knossos by rental car, but I want to contrast that with the trouble we had actually getting out of Heraklion and finding the national highway to go to their next stop, which is Rethymno. First of all, the road was not that well marked to find our way to the national highway, and so we basically ended up finding it only by dead reckoning, almost by just following a car at random, and as we see more cars, maybe that's the way out of town. I normally have a very good sense of direction, but we were very lost because we really were trying to follow the signs, and it would have been better if we had just gone back down towards the harbor and then out that way. And then once you get to the National Highway, Crete driving is interesting because as we were driving around the cities, I really didn't find it that much different, at least from driving in any other Mediterranean country. But on the National Highway, it's a nice new road. It's most of the time striped for two lanes and driven as four. And so what that means is, as you're driving in Crete, you generally, unless you're passing, will drive with your right tire on the white line for the shoulder or over the white line, actually onto the shoulder. You'll see trucks driving down the road completely on the shoulder. Because, one, you want to leave room for people to pass you, because they're going to pass you at any place on a turn. It doesn't matter how it's striped. It doesn't matter what the speed limit is marked at. And then also because there's going to be somebody doing the same thing in the other direction heading towards you. And so we were passed by Lamborghini, for instance, straddling the center line coming right at me, or trucks coming at me in my lane while we were driving. So it's an interesting experience and probably not for the timid. And then our next two stops were Rethymno and Chania, and they're very similar towns. And of the two, I would say my favorite is probably Rethymno, but it's probably as much because we were just getting tired and it was close to the end of the trip by the time we got to Chania. But they're really both wonderful, lovely towns, and they are both a beach town. Especially Rethymno has a quite a long, very lovely sandy beach. It may be the nicest beach I have seen so far in Europe, and I certainly haven't seen every beach, but certainly a nicer beach than the beaches of south of France, for instance, which are much more well-known. But then in addition to this beach town, you also have the old town, which is right next to it, and has in Rethymno a large fortress with it, and it has these lovely twisted streets, mostly with shops, probably more craft shops in Rethymno and more name brand shops in Chania, but it just depends. The ladies would be quite contented for hours just walking around shopping, and I would be quite contented walking around in the back alleys taking pictures of lovely cafes and old doors and old buildings and just a very beautiful town. And then, of course, when you finally get hungry, there's food everywhere, sidewalk cafes as well as street vendors. And most of the food that we saw in all of Greece is Greek food. And I love Greek food. We had a lot of gyros and souvlaki and moussaka and Those were probably the three things that we ordered more often than not. But we did get a little tired of Greek food after a little while, just because we were longing for something different, because we're used to having more variety in our food. There is, I'm told, a Mexican restaurant, Señor Zorba's, in Rethymno, which is pretty good, and two Chinese restaurants in Chania, which are also pretty decent, we were told by Helen. And of course, in front of all of the restaurants, there's somebody who is standing outside almost as a carnival barker who is trying to get you to come into their restaurant, especially since a lot of the restaurants do have really the same menu. The role of kamaki, one who speaks, is very important. And we were told this by a kamaki who we struck up a conversation with, who is named Baran from Serbia, who also gave us some tips on which were the best beaches to go to, because he had a little time to talk to us, because it wasn't quite mealtime, and again, it wasn't high season. We also did get a special chance to get outside of the cities, and that's because when we did get to Chania, we called Helen up, who had asked us to call her, who we met on the ferry, and she had plans to go that day up to a restaurant in a village as far up as you could go, south of Chania into the White Mountains, and we went with her to this wonderful restaurant that is in a village of only four houses, although they're building some more now for tourists, it looks like, that it had just wonderful food. We ate food that was common at a Cretan wedding. Cretan weddings are quite large affairs. Helen had been to one that had 1,000 people at it. And baptisms are also big parties with maybe 100 people at them. One of the dishes that was particularly good, but I won't use the name that she translated it with, but let's just say that after the wedding, the rice might be called euphemistically consummation rice. Just a beautiful area as you wind the roads up into the hills there. One thing I didn't mention about Cretan driving is that not everybody makes those turns or makes that passing successfully. And when you fail, they will create a small memorial on the side of the road, quite often looking like a Greek Orthodox church, where they will leave remembrances for the person who misses one of those mountain roads or doesn't quite get far enough over on the national highway. The highlights of Crete, the palace of Knossos, and the towns of both Heraklion, Chania, and Rethymno, and do take the opportunity also to try and get out into some of the smaller villages in the hills, and that was truly a wonderful experience also. With that, I've got just one internet resource for you today, and that is an article that I wrote about getting over jet lag, which was a subject that was near and dear to me this week as we were trying to recover from a 10-hour time zone difference. So check that out. I'll put a link to that in the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. And then as we do transition into community news, I am trying to do some more monetization of the podcast, as I mentioned. The first thing that I have for you is that I'm creating an affiliate page. If you do get a chance and would like to support the show, if you go to amateurtraveler.com/affiliates, you'll find some links you can click on. If, for instance, you're going to book a rental car through Budget, then if you book it through that page, then I will get a small cut of that, which will help support the show. The other idea I had, and I'm interested in your feedback on this idea, one thing that occurred to me as I watched tour groups go through Fira on Santorini, and they got dropped off in one place and walked about a 10-block area and then went down the gondola, and that was all they saw of Santorini, is I really do enjoy independent travel, and that is obviously something that this show talks about more than tour group travel, but some people don't feel equipped to do that, and I'm thinking about the possibility of doing a class on the internet on how to be an independent traveler. Because of the time it would take to prepare this, this is probably something that I would need to charge for. And so I'm just curious if you think that you or someone you know would find that interesting, and if so, what kind of topics you would want to have covered. I'm thinking how to book travel. I'm thinking how to use subway systems. I'm thinking about how to pack. Just a lot of different things occur to me. So just let me know your thoughts in that, whether that sounds like something that would be an interesting. For many of you, I think you're past that stage, but I'm wondering if there are some of you that would find that interesting to sort of get you out of the tour bus and onto your own in some of the ways that we talk about on the show. With that, we'll wrap up this episode and bring it to a close. I'd be interested in your feedback. Go to amateurtraveler.com and leave a comment, or send me an email at host@amateurtraveler.com. And as always, Thanks so much for listening.